Floods in Pakistan, an earthquake in Haiti, war in Darfur, all very different crises with a common denominator. Millions in dire need of food, water, shelter, and medicine. The United Nations gets the call to respond to global disasters, but must rely on member countries for supplies and support through the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Sir John Holmes held the post of Undersecretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator and oversaw emergency relief to Haiti and, most recently, to Pakistan. If you have questions for him about the challenges of disaster relief missions and why it's often proved so difficult to rally global support for Pakistan, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk at npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Sir John Holmes, now director of the Ditchley Foundation, a London-based think tank, and joins us from the studios of the BBC in Oxford. Good to have you with us today.
Very good to be with you.
And the earthquake in Haiti fell under your watch. Can you just give us some idea of the phone call you got and how quickly you got things into motion?
I can. It was in the evening in New York time when we first started to hear about the earthquake in Haiti. And of course, the trouble is you don't know when you first hear exactly how bad it is, exactly how big it is, what the damage is, how many people have been killed and so on. But it became clear very quickly, not least from talking to our own UN colleagues, because of course the UN headquarters in Haiti had collapsed as well, that this was really a huge earthquake, a major disaster, and that we needed to get moving on it absolutely straight away, which is what we did, of course.
And people might imagine there are warehouses full of food and ships and helicopters ready to ferry them. That's not the case.
No, obviously there are stockpiles around the world. In fact, there were some stocks of food in Haiti, as it happened, for a World Food Programme school feeding programme, but those warehouses themselves were hit by the earthquake, so they weren't accessible. And that was one of the problems we faced, that the organisations that were there, whether they were from the UN or from NGOs, were themselves very badly affected, both their people and their offices, and therefore that made it all the harder to get the operation up and running. It takes time. People are ready, all sorts of organisations are ready, but they have to be coordinated, they have to be able to get in there, the port's got to be working, the airport's got to be working, and neither was right at the beginning. So, you know, all this means that the start of these disasters is very chaotic, is very difficult. People are expecting aid straight away. It can take a little bit of time to mobilise it and get the food and clean water people need to them.
And given the arrangements, are you the person in charge, or is your representative the person in charge, says, you do this, you do that?
Yes, obviously, we it's a complicated matter because we don't direct people exactly about what to do. These are very often independent, non-governmental organizations like World Vision or Oxfam or Save the Children, together with the UN agencies, the World Food Programme, the World Health Organization, and many others, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So we can't tell them what to do. What we need to do is make sure they're all working together. That's our particular role in life, as well as raising money for them, and make sure that they are not duplicating each other and not leaving gaps in either in coverage of particular issues like medical supplies or water or food, or in geographical coverage. And that's the basic things of what we do. But we're also trying to raise awareness of the needs that are there, appeal to governments and individuals to give us the money we need to do this with, because otherwise we can do virtually nothing. And also to make sure everybody's mobilizing as fast as possible to help. And for a major disaster like Haiti, or even more so now for the huge disaster in Pakistan, this is a big challenge.
And Pakistan, of course, different in many respects, but one of them sort of a slow-moving crisis rather than the shock of the earth, the literal shock of the earthquake in Haiti.
I think that was one of the big differences between the two. I mean, Haiti, an earthquake, but particularly the earthquake in Haiti in the capital city, was a hugely dramatic event with more than 200,000 people killed, dramatic pictures of collapsed buildings, dramatic rescues going on for 10 days, a hugely sort of heart-wrenching kind of tragedy which had an immediate televisual appeal. And that showed itself in the way people responded, not only in the US and Europe, but also all around the world, in providing money both from governments and from individuals and NGOs. In Pakistan, it was a much more slowly building disaster. It's still going on even now, still getting worse in some places. And, of course, a flood doesn't have quite the same emotional impact, if you like, as an earthquake, because it's less sudden. There are far fewer people killed, only a couple of thousand people killed rather than 200,000. So it doesn't have that immediate impact, and it, therefore it doesn't get the emotional response, and therefore the resources are harder to mobilize. Maybe the fact that it happened in August was a factor. Maybe the fact that people do not have as much sympathy in some ways for Pakistan as they might have for some other places. Maybe that also played a role too, but it has been hard to generate the resources for Pakistan.
Our guest, Sir John Holmes, director now of the Ditchley Foundation, former Undersecretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Jay's on the line from San Francisco.
Yes, I'd like to see the UN figure out a way to deal with the distribution of humanitarian aid in a non-permissive environment. That is, in a country where the host, in a situation where the host nation rejects assistance. Two current examples, one being Burma and the other current-day Pakistan, where you have U.S. military ready, willing, and able to do more, but the host nation doesn't want it because of political considerations. And I think there's two reasons. One is that we can alleviate a lot of human suffering. In the case of Pakistan, we could go a long ways to totally rewrite the narrative of how the Islamic world sees the United States.
Is that the situation as you saw it in Pakistan, Sir Joseph?
I think that's not quite the situation in Pakistan. I think on this particular occasion, the Pakistanis have welcomed outside help. The Americans have been giving that help in very generous ways, using the military helicopters, and of course civilian organizations as well. So it's not so much been the government that's the problem. There are areas of Pakistan, unfortunately, where it's very dangerous to operate because of the Taliban. And their continuing battle against the government, in which aid organizations can very easily get caught up, and we have lost quite a number of people over the last year because of that. Our situation in Burma, Myanmar, was a bit different. There the government, this was in Cyclone Nargis, a huge tidal wave which killed about 140,000 people in 2008. There the problem was the government was saying, well, we don't mind having your money, but we don't want your aid experts, we don't want your people walking around our territory. And we then had to go there a couple of times myself with the Secretary General of the United Nations to try to persuade the government that there was no risk to them from aid workers going in. These were not spies. They were not soldiers. They were simply there to help people who needed that help. And we were able to persuade the government after a few weeks hard bargaining that that's what they needed. And it did work reasonably well in the end.
After a few weeks, those were a few weeks when people did not get aid.
It was very difficult and extremely frustrating. And, of course, there were calls from some people that we should be somehow imposing aid on a country. But I have to say it's very, very difficult to operate in a country without the help and support of the government. We've looked at that in different circumstances and usually concluded that actually trying to bring aid in against the wishes of the government simply will not work and will not really help the people. Now, what we do have a real problem with, as I said, in the case of Pakistan, is where you have some kind of illegal armed group, a rebel group, whoever they might be, who has decided that outside aid is interference in his country, or is identified with a kind of alien culture or alien religion, if you like, in some way, quite wrongly, of course. That's where we have to be very careful about how we operate and how we establish contact, even with these groups, even with the nastiest groups, if you like, to persuade them that we're not there to impose our will. We're simply there to help people who are desperately in need of help at that particular moment.
Yet, to follow up on Jay's point, some of those groups are going to see this as a political threat to their attempts to win sway over the people. If aid is coming in from Britain and the United States and from Brazil and other places, they would prefer to provide whatever meager assistance they could and get the benefit of being the benefactors.
Well, that can be the case. We are very much operating as non-political groups, non-political organizations in very highly politicized situations, as in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Sudan or Somalia. And this does provide a lot of dilemmas. But what we have to do is to persuade these groups that it is simply inhuman of them to resist or to try to keep out international aid organizations whose only objective is to help the people, you know, in whose name they claim to speak. And sometimes we succeed and sometimes we don't, but that's one of the struggles we constantly have.
Jay, thanks very much for the call. Good question. Let's go next to, this is Ryan, and Ryan's on the line from Lawrence, Kansas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, I wanted to make a comment earlier because I heard him talking about how slow that the funds have been to getting around in Haiti. Well, I read a recent report, well, not so recent now, it's a couple months old, saying that less than 2% of all of the funds had been disbursed, or like less than 3%. I mean, like, I understand that it can take like a long time because there needs to be like delegation and planning. But you know, 3% in almost a year. I mean, that seems a little. That seems like low even for slow standards. I mean.
I think Sir John Holmes was talking about how slow donations. I think he was talking about how slow donations were to Pakistan. But to get to Ryan's question, has a disbursement of these funds been slow?
Well, I think you need to distinguish between the humanitarian situation and humanitarian relief, where the funds are dispersed very quickly, and indeed we run out of money very quickly, and so 100% of what we're getting is being spent almost as quickly as we get it. So the 3% that you're talking about is not applying, it is not relevant to the humanitarian relief funds. What that story was about was that the very large sums of money had been promised at a donor conference in New York in March for reconstruction of Haiti, and very little of that money at that stage had appeared and been disbursed. Now, that's now beginning to happen. It is a much more long-term project, obviously. But there is, I mean, there is frustration about that slowness, but that's a very different thing from the humanitarian immediate relief needs that people have, which are being met and where the money is used straight away.
Thanks very much for the call, Ryan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Sir John Holmes, former Undersecretary General and of Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And how do you decide when the period for emergency relief is over and reconstruction begins and you can begin to scale down?
Well, it's different in each different situation. But normally speaking, in a major natural disaster, you'd expect the immediate relief operations to be winding down after 6 months or so, and what we call early recovery really beginning. But of course, these two things are not totally separate. One runs into the other. They often run in parallel. For example, in Pakistan now, obviously people need immediate help when they've been flooded out. They need food, clean water, medical supplies and shelter. Those are the four basics. But very quickly, when the water goes down, what they also need is help to get back to their normal lives. And in particular, the farmers, and most of them are farmers, probably 90% of those affected are farmers. They need help to re-establish their agricultural activities. They need tools, they need seeds, they need fertilizers, they need credit, all sorts of things like that. They need that very quickly so they can then not miss a planting season, because if they miss a planting season, there'll be hunger down the road. So getting that sort of operation up and running very quickly is almost as important as getting the immediate relief in.
Here's an email from a listener. We always hear about the need for clean water after disasters, Haiti, Pakistan. Perhaps the UN Refugee Agency could stock and distribute small backpack water purifiers to disaster areas within days of the need becoming apparent. Is there anything like that in train?
We do have things like that. Obviously, we don't really want to provide people with bottled water in large quantities. It's very expensive. It ruins the environment because the bottles tend to clog everything up after a while. What's much better is to purify the water supplies that are there. And there are various ways of doing that. We can often use, as we do, water purification tablets, which are supplied in very large quantities and can then make dirty water acceptable, if not particularly palatable. Then we can bring in, and as soon as we can, we do bring in water purification plants, which can be large or small. They take a little bit of time to set up, but they can then produce large quantities of drinking water. And there are also more imaginative ideas and technologies around. For example, there is a drinking straw, which has a filter halfway up the straw, which means that you can be sucking in dirty water and it appears in your mouth as again, palatable and drinkable water, which will not give you diseases. So there are technological solutions to this, which we're trying to perfect all the time.
We talked about the difficulties in Burma and to some degree in Pakistan of delivering aid where groups or governments may not want it. Then there are the ongoing situations, but at least those are short-term situations. Ongoing situations like Darfur, where all kinds of politics are involved, and you're trying to provide aid to people who are, in a sense, the targets of a civil conflict.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's where it does become much more difficult than it does in a natural disaster situation. Natural disasters can be political, as we've just been talking about, but mm-hmm. the big conflicts in Sudan, in Darfur, Somalia or Congo, where you're trying to deliver aid in a situation where some kind of conflict or civil war is continuing, that's extremely difficult. And, for example, in Sudan, we have constant struggles with the Sudanese government, who, although they quite like the fact that we're supplying food to people, because otherwise they would have to do it, at the same time are very suspicious of our motives and very worried that we're getting in the way of their political objectives. And that creates a very difficult, long-running tension between the government and the aid organisations, which sometimes results in, for example, as it did last year, in expulsions of aid organisations. And that has a very bad effect on the people we're trying to help. But, of course, at the same time, long-running situations like that create their own problems of aid dependency, which no one wants to see, where people have lost the habit of looking after themselves. And that's a very dangerous phenomenon, too, which we have to watch very carefully.
Because, at least in part, one of the goals of those attacking those people is to get them to give up their way of life.
Well, particularly in cases like Darfur, where there are different ethnic groups, different tribal groups, there's competition, as Jan Eliasson was saying earlier, over grazing rights and over water, which are becoming more scarce because of climate change and the creeping advance of the desert and so on. They get into very complicated situations where the aid agencies are trying again to be non-political, totally non-political, just giving aid to whoever needs it, whichever side they're on, whichever group is controlling them. But you're doing this in the middle of very, very strongly competing groups, parties, governments, rebel movements, whatever, all trying to influence you in their different ways. And that's where the balancing act becomes extremely complicated.
Sir John Holmes, thanks so much for your time today and good luck to you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Sir John Holmes, director of the Ditchley Foundation in London. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Oxford. Tomorrow, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell debate on the Hill. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert plan competing marches on the National Mall. And Carl Paladino, the GOP nominee, the Tea Party nominee for governor in the state of New York, will join us, along with political junkie Ken Rudin. Be with us for that. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.